This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're all used to walking into the doctor's office, rolling up our sleeves, and getting our cholesterol levels checked with a simple blood test. Imagine if it could be so simple for cancer. No biopsies, no MRIs, just a blood test. That's the hope, even if just the glimmer of one, that was raised today with the announcement of revolutionary new research at Massachusetts General Hospital, where scientists have developed a prototype microchip that can detect cancer cells in the bloodstream. Today, MGH announced a partnership with Johnson & Johnson that will push the technology out of the prototype phase and into doctors' offices. Or at least, that's the hope. It could change the way we test for, treat, and understand cancer. We're joined now on the line by Dr. Daniel Haber. He's director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center and one of the researchers at work on this new test. Dr. Haber, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So tell us, you are using a new kind of microchip for a blood test for cancer. How does that work?
The idea is that cancers can spread, as we know, from where they arise into the bloodstream and then onto distant sites like the lung, the brain, bones, the liver, and that's often what causes the death from cancer. So the challenge is, can we find these cancer cells when they're in transit in the blood? And can we pull them out, count them, analyze them, and try to understand the process by which cancer spreads? When these cancer cells are in the blood, they're very, very rare. So they're surrounded, each cancer cell may be surrounded by up to a billion normal blood cells. And there's a big challenge then in trying to figure out how can you get the cancer cells to come out of the particular tube that you're looking at and let the blood cells just flow through.
So how have you overcome that challenge with this new technology?
Well, the technology that we've developed over the last couple of years with the support of Stand Up to Cancer, which is a national telethon, has been to develop a microfluidic chip that's a tiny, tiny little channel. And we have a teaspoon of blood full of billions of blood cells flow through this tiny little channel. And the channel is arranged with a kind of glue which captures the tumor cells but allows the blood cells to flow through.
And I understand that it can detect as few as 10 of these cancer cells per these millions of regular blood cells?
It's extremely sensitive. We don't know the right answer in terms of how many cells we should be picking up because we don't really know what's there. We can only identify what we can find. So when we pull out tumor cells with this glue, we can usually find anywhere from 1 to 50 cells per teaspoon of blood from a patient with cancer.
Okay, so needless to say, though, it's a completely different way of looking for cancerous cells in the body. So at this point in time, what specific types of cancer have you been able to detect with this prototype microchip?
It depends very much on the glue that we use. We're using a glue which is quite common to the most common cancers. So we can pick up lung cancers and breast and colon, pancreas, and prostate. We're trying to develop different types of glues to be able to find cells in melanomas and different ones in brain tumors and so on. So it's an evolving process, and the technology is evolving very, very quickly.
So quickly that are we likely to see this technology through the new partnership with Johnson & Johnson in doctors' offices anytime soon?
Our dream would be that it's soon. It's going to take some time. The prototype that we have now is quite complicated to make and to operate. And again, through Stand Up to Cancer, we can roll it out to four different institutions. But to really go nationwide, we need a different kind of device, which will be simpler, cheaper, more reliable, and one that you could distribute everywhere. And that's the goal of the Johnson & Johnson arrangement. The deal is over 5 years. I hope that over the next few years, we can make a tremendous amount of progress. But again, this is a technology which is evolving every day.
So I can understand that at this point in time, you've done the test on patients who have already received a diagnosis for cancer. And in fact, they have metastatic cancer, which, as you said, it means the cancer cells are in their blood and not just at the site of the original tumor. So, is that the type of thing that we'll see in the future, that you won't be diagnosing new cases, but detecting cancer in patients who already have it? Is that the next step, or is the next step something along the lines of what I described earlier, that it'll be as common as a cholesterol screening?
I think it's a question of time. Right now, if we imagine over the next few years, the sensitivity of the device is such that we can follow cancer in patients who we know already have cancer. That's actually very important because the more effective new treatments that we have against cancer, the so-called smart drugs, really hone in on a genetic abnormality in the cancer. Everybody has a different type of genetic abnormality, and you can't just treat every cancer the same way. So in some way, you really have to know what are the abnormalities in the cancer and how do they change during the course of treatment. So that's what we imagine is going to be the most immediate application, is picking the right drug, particularly for this new generation of targeted therapies.
So you have a powerful new tool to potentially fine-tune therapies here. Does that also mean that our conventional means of diagnosing cancer right now, the MRIs and biopsies, that those may go the way of the dodo sometime soon and we'll just have this blood test?
I think they'll be combined with it. And what we can already tell from some very, very early studies is that a very small number of patients who have cancer that hasn't spread already have some cells that we can find in the blood. So as the technology improves and gets better, one day it might actually be possible to use this for early diagnosis or for diagnosing more invasive cancers versus those that don't need to be treated, particularly something in prostate cancer, which is a big question. So I think as the technology gets better and better, the applications will move from treatment of known cancer to early detection of cancers that are not known. And that's presumably where we'll save lives.
Dr. Haber, I understand that initially the funding for this research, this really revolutionary research, did not come from the federal government. And now you've got a partnership with a private company, Johnson & Johnson, in order to further develop and commercialize this technology. So in terms of the research that MGH is doing on cancer, is this sort of a prototype for how we might see medical breakthroughs coming out of your lab and other labs in the future?
Well, it's been a long road with many different investigators, engineers, clinicians, molecular biologists. The first generation was actually funded by the NIH, by the government, together with the Ellison Foundation, and actually MGH itself put in a very significant contribution to develop the first generation. The second generation chip, which we use now, is funded by Stand Up to Cancer, which again is a national telethon and philanthropy. And this commercial deal involves yet a third generation to be built, which will be commercialized. So in some way, yes, every part of the world has contributed to making this happen, from our own institution to the government to foundations, and then on now to the commercial sector, which we feel is what we're going to need to really make this work and make this broadly available.
Dr. Haber, you're an oncologist, you're a cancer researcher. You deal day in and day out with not only sort of the biological and scientific side of this, but also the emotional, medical, and societal impact that cancer has. So what do you think that the impact could be about this with this new, potentially revolutionary or transformative way of testing for cancer?
Well, I think this test is only part of the equation, and it's an important part that has to come along with new drugs and new treatments. So in some way, what we're seeing now is a revolution in the treatment of cancer with new drugs that are smart drugs and are designed against individual cancers. So in some way, our device makes it possible to test and apply these new drugs better and in a more quick way so that we can find out who's responding and who's not. So I think there are many branches to this treatment of cancer. Diagnostics is going to be one, new therapies is going to be the others, and of course there are going to be all kinds of other measures from public health to lifestyles that we have to improve as well. So I really see it as part of the whole, but an important one that should be enabling for these new treatments.
And all those additional treatments have costs and consequences of their own, which we'll take a look at just after a short break. Dr. Daniel Haber, director of the MGH Cancer Center, please stand by. Listeners, I've got to ask you, what do you think about the possibility of a new blood test for cancer? Would you rather do that over a mammogram or colonoscopy? I mean, it sounds pretty good, but is there a downside to maybe an extreme form of early detection for cancer? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about revolutionary cancer research out of Massachusetts General Hospital and how a new blood test could change the way we test for, treat, and understand the disease. Listeners, does cancer run in your family? And would you consider taking a blood test to screen for cancer if it becomes available? Perhaps you've already tested positive for some cancer genes and you've had to take serious preventative steps after receiving the results. How did that go for you? What's your story in the story of cancer? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined by Dr. Daniel Haber. He's director of the MGH Cancer Center and one of the researchers working on this new blood-based cancer test. And I'd also like to welcome into the conversation Dr. Michael Groden. He's professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University's School of Public Health. Dr. Groden, welcome to Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
So, you know, this technology sounds extremely exciting, and I'm sure many people out there are just waiting for the moment that they can actually walk into their doctor's office and get a blood test for cancer. But what are your initial thoughts?
Well, first of all, we have to be careful. Revolutionary is a big word. And I'm not sure that I would call it revolutionary at this point. It's in the research phase. And the first question, of course, is, does it work? Is it accurate? Does it actually get the cells that they need, the cells that are related to the tumor? And what do we do with those cells, and how do we interpret the meaning of the results? And, of course, the ultimate thing is whether we're going to have more good than harm. And so the question is, what valuable information can you glean from this? The technology is pretty remarkable, that you can take a cell from the peripheral blood, which comes from a tumor. And so that's technically very good. And the question, though, is with that cell, what will we do with it and how will we gain information from it? And there are three different levels to this question. One is, as you mentioned, the disease, treatment of the disease, in which case we monitor the tumor and we monitor to see if there's extension of the tumor. Second is testing the susceptibility of the tumor to various drugs. That needs to be shown to be helpful and effective. But the two things that you alluded to are far off. One is an at-risk population, a population, for instance, that has BRCA1, which is the cancer gene for breast cancer, mm-hmm. or colon cancer, which may have a genetic susceptibility. And those at-risk diseases, the question is, what does it mean to have these cells? Are the cells actually representative of the tumor, or do we normally have cells in our peripheral bloodstream? And the third case is population-based screening, which is what you're talking about, cholesterol screening. These are people not at risk, but people who are just in the general population. And each of those has a unique set of problems and issues that are associated with it.
Dr. Haber, I mean, let me give you a chance to respond to Dr. Groden there. The prototype is in its early phases, but are these questions that you'll be grappling with as you try to push it out, the technology, into the general medical populace?
Absolutely. I mean, I agree completely with what Dr. Groden has said, that it's easy to study something when you know that a patient has cancer. When you're looking at healthy individuals, then the quality, the robustness, the reliability becomes incredibly important. The one thing that I would add in between these is that there are even patients who have nodules or lumps, and those are the ones that we now have a clinical trial to study to see in patients who have a suspected primary lesion, can we find these CTCs? So I think caution is the right thing, that you have to start with patients who have cancer, then those who are suspected of having cancer, those who are at increased genetic risk for developing cancer, and testing the general population is something that we would see very, very in the distant future once the test has really been proven.
There also is the question about whether these tumor cells naturally, occasionally we have an abnormal tumor cell in the bloodstream, which is not related to a cancer, and the immune system gets rid of it. There was a theory at one point that people who have immune deficiency get cancers because their immune system is screwed up. So, I mean, I think the question of what the meaning is of a cancer cell in somebody who doesn't have a solid tumor diagnosed is going to be a real problem, and a real question. We know the prostate-specific antigen, which is done as a screening for men with prostate cancer, is very complicated to understand and interpret, and I would imagine the same thing will be true as we get cells.
Dr. Haber, let me follow up with Dr. Groden on that and ask you, I mean, is there a risk for false positives, for example, if you can detect so few potential cancer cells in such a huge volume of blood?
Well, clearly at this point we're not using this in patients who don't have cancer, so we haven't tested that application or that risk. We've tested healthy volunteers and healthy controls, and we've set the bar so that for these patients we don't see cells, and we only measure cells that are above a particular level. But we do have, to Dr. Grodin's point, we do have a clinical trial now at MGH to test patients who come to the hospital for non-cancer diagnoses and are age matched with the ones that we study for cancer, and see what actually we see in the general population. I think it's a long way before we start applying this to patients not known to have cancer.
We've got a ton of callers who want to join us. Let's get to them. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack is calling from Salem. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jack.
Hi. Good to be on the air. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What's your thought?
I just think that while early detection of cancer is fantastic and obviously very important, I think also we have to make sure that we recognize that not all cancers even need to be treated. In fact, a large percentage of cancers don't need treatment or anything more than monitoring. And I think it's important that even if we do detect more cancers, there'd be a way to tell, is this something that needs to be treated or not? Because it costs a huge amount of money to treat, and there's a lot of over-treatment, especially in oncology.
Jack, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Grodin, I mean, that's a question that you raised with prostate cancer,
right?
For a specific. Are we at risk of over-diagnosis?
Well, I
here?
Think absolutely. And the question of what's the natural history of these cancers, with or without treatment and monitoring it, is a very critical question. We know that men who die of old age, many of them have cancer cells in their prostate, which apparently they've lived with for a long time and has not spread. And so that would be a mistake to diagnose and treat that when it's going to be part of the natural course of the disease. So I think that this is a question which is very, very relevant.
Let's get another call. Oh, sorry, Dr. Haber, go ahead.
I would just agree that it's one of the best examples of what could be the utility of circulating tumor cells. There's a number of trials that have been supported by the Prostate Cancer Foundation here, and they all look at whether we can find these circulating cells in patients who have localized prostate cancer before it has actually become metastatic. And in some cases we do, and in some cases we don't, and we're now following these patients to see what happens. So very much what we need in prostate cancer is something beyond PSA, something that could potentially add to the equation and tell us this prostate cancer is invading into the blood, this one isn't, and see if that has clinical value. So I would argue this kind of test, if it turns out to be correct, could be very, very useful in distinguishing invasive from non-invasive cancers.
Diane is calling from Medfield. Welcome to Radio Boston, Diane.
Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if the test down the road would be available in place of a mammogram, because that's something that I dread each year.
Dr. Haber and Dr. Grodin, too, feel free to chime in as well. I mean, that's one thing that we've been here at Radio Boston wondering all day. Like, so many people just don't want to have those more invasive tests. That could this be basically the way that we get more people into doctor's office for really early screening and diagnosis?
I would be concerned about giving out that hope. I think right now we have a very early research test that one day in the distant future might be a diagnostic which we can use for early screening, but that day is not here now. So right now we know that mammograms work. We know that they're important. I would say the first application that I could see for CTCs is eventually, and that's still a couple of years from now, if someone has an abnormality on a mammogram, you could then go and do a CTC test and see whether or not it needs to be biopsied. So I could imagine this kind of conjunctive test, but even that would be years into the future. So for right now, I would very much discourage anybody from not using a proven diagnostic to detect cancer, whether it's in the prostate, whether it's in breast or in colon.
Yeah, the question around all these tests is what to do with the information and how to manage the information. And as these tests become more available and more widely used, it's going to be a real problem. It's going to be a real dilemma as to how to interpret and how to understand what to do, because we don't know about the natural history of many of these cancers. The other thing I would mention, by the way, is the cost is a relevant issue. And of course, the question of justice and access is going to become an issue. If and assuming this test does become more widely available, the question is, who's going to pay for it?
Those are questions I absolutely want to get to, but I want to also get to a couple other callers. First, we are talking about a new research coming out of Massachusetts General Hospital, a potential new blood test that could screen for cancer. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rami is calling from Sudbury. Welcome to Radio Boston, Rami.
Hello, yes, thank you. My question is, since the immune system takes care of a lot of the estimated maybe 1,000 to 10,000 cancer cells that we have at any given time, is this just going to cause increased anxiety for folks, which we know decreases immune system function? And I worry that this would create additional worry for those people who do get the test, sort of in the general population.
We can already imagine, for example, the anxiety and heartache that women who get tested for the breast cancer gene have. Imagine that many more people who could potentially face such decisions with a blood test, Dr. Grodin.
In fact, the breast cancer gene is a probability. It doesn't mean that you have the disease when you have the gene. It means that there's a susceptibility, so it's even more complicated. It's just a probabilistic combination. And monitoring somebody over time, many of those women, of course, will never develop cancer at all. And most breast cancer is not genetic at all.
I would like to bring one more voice into this conversation on the patient's side of things. Joining us now is Thomas Sellers. He's the president of the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship. Mr. Sellers, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
I understand that you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. Can you just tell us a little bit about how your diagnosis came about and what options you were given for treatment?
Yes, I was diagnosed as a result of an elevated PSA score. I was high risk. My dad had prostate cancer, and I'm African American, so I had three out of the four risk factors. And once I was diagnosed, I actually was treated in Boston and got great treatment up there and ultimately chose to have surgery to remove my prostate.
So you've been through this. You have firsthand experience about what it's like to take a test and figure out or be told that you have cancer. So what's your response to, as a patient advocate, to the possibility that so many more people potentially in the future could get could have to face a similar situation as you because of a simple blood test?
Well, I think you have to be very, very careful to understand the implications of the science and whether or not, the blood test is actually going to be useful in a general population. And I think both doctors have indicated that it's not ready yet to look as a general preventive basis. But even in patients like me who have had cancer and have been monitored over a number of years, we need to understand exactly what these cells are like that they're finding in the bloodstream. What does it mean to us if I've been, zero PSA for 11 or 12 years, and then if they did the blood test, they find cells in the bloodstream? Does that mean that I need to be worried about it being metastatic at this point? And it also doesn't deal with the emotional anxiety that you have every year when you go for your test to see whether or not the cancer has recurred.
And what do you make of this issue that Dr. Grodin brought up? And I do want to turn it also back to Dr. Grodin and Dr. Haber, that in addition to the emotional anxiety that people might have with an annual test or screening, that we'll also potentially be faced with a whole new set of costs for early treatment and ongoing treatment of maybe many more people who have some kind of diagnosis or detection of cancer.
I think Dr. Grodin pointed out that, we've had a lot of experience with the PSA test, which increased the number of diagnoses of prostate cancer, and there may be some number of those that don't need to be treated. But the issue is, and the real key is, finding out whether or not the particular tumor that's being diagnosed is one that is going to be particularly dangerous to you. So if this process helps us better identify whether or not it's a dangerous tumor, then that's a good thing because it'll reduce the amount of inappropriate treatment that might happen.
If I could chime in, that I think that point is exactly the one that I would envisage, which is that if it turns out that we do find these cells in patients with early cancer, and if it turns out that turns out to be a marker of tumors that invade into the bloodstream, those could be the ones that really do need treatment as opposed to others. And as you know, in the U.S., we probably over-treat prostate cancer. In some European countries, they probably under-treat prostate cancer. Nobody really knows which cancer is going to recur or not. So this kind of information is very, very useful, or eventually will have the potential to be useful. The other point
that's
I wanted to make,
really hope.
Sorry, the only point I wanted really to make hope. Is that all these kind of new technologies have risks and anxieties and uncertainty associated with this. we had maybe 10 years ago, we had found a high frequency of BRCA mutations in Ashkenazi Jewish women.
That's and for I breast cancer.
A tremendous discussion about, do we want to know? Is it worth knowing this kind of information and all the anxiety that comes with it? And now if you look 10 years later, there are specific treatments that are more effective in breast cancers that arise in carriers of BRCA mutations. So often, you first have a new technology, you don't really know how to apply it, it comes with anxiety, but with time it turns out to be a benefit because, in fact, it informs the kind of treatments that you give.
Let me turn that to Dr. Grodin.
Which is exactly why we need to go very, very slow, be very cautious, and to study what we do before we do it, and to try to understand what the implications are. But we have to be very cautious and take slow, slow steps.
Dr. Herbert,
we have to understand how that it may improve survivorship. And if that's the case, we can only hope that it will fulfill its promise in the future.
And the way medical technology is progressing, these concurrent questions will always be with us. So let me just leave everyone with one last question to Dr. Haber. Do you have a sense that, the reason why you've partnered with Johnson & Johnson is to really accelerate the timetable to get this technology out into doctors' offices across the country. I mean, I know I asked this before, but I wasn't quite sure what I heard in your answer. Is it 5 years, 10 years, 2 years before we may have some kind of blood screen or not?
Well, right now, for research purposes, we have dozens of these chips that we use at MGH. So again, it's a very limited research question. To get to the point where you can make this broadly available, you need thousands of these. And for that, we need to make a different kind of chip, which is more readily made and scaled up. And that's the goal of the Johnson & Johnson agreement, is to try to develop a scalable chip that can be used.
Doctor,
so our hope is that that would be available in the 3 to 5 year range. But again, the chip has yet to be made that could be scaled to that level.
Dr. Daniel Haber, director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center and one of the researchers at work on this new test, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Thomas Sellers, president of the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Michael Grodin, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at the Boston University School of Public Health, thank you so much for coming back to Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
Up next, 2010 was the year of Scott Brown, who was named Bostonian of the Year this weekend by the Boston Globe. So what will 2011 bring for the Republican from Wrentham? And what about the State House? We'll get the political forecast from Beacon Hill. We'll be back after a short break. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.